The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from GQ Magazine and Pocket's Read It Later website. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Now, today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to feature an article about people who try to climb Mount Everest. Chaos at the Top of the World is an article written by Joshua Hammer for GQ Magazine, and it later appeared on Pocket's Read It Later website in February 2024. Now, we're going to begin with a photo caption that gives us a graphic picture of what we will experience. Now, I need to remind you that this travelogue includes stories of life and death and can be somewhat graphic at times, okay? So, let's now read the photo caption and begin the article in just a moment. Again, it's titled Chaos at the Top of the World. It was one of the most viral photos of 2019. A horde of climbers clogged atop Mount Everest, but it only begins to capture the deadly realities of what transpired that day at 29,000 feet. Now the article. It was morning and bright, and Reinhard Grubhofer, depleted and hydrated, hoisted his body over a crest and rose uneasily. There, from the summit of Mount Everest, he could see everything. How the earth curved gorgeously in all directions. How wisps of clouds sailed beneath his boots. The view, out beyond his worries, was beautiful, but closer at hand he could see trouble taking shape. He could feel it, too, shuffling with a dozen other climbers onto a slim patch of ground roughly the size of two ping-pong tables. The space was crowded. Shakily, Grubhofer held up a small flag and posed for photos with his climbing partner, a fellow Austrian named Ernst Landgraf, who'd made the slog to the summit uneasily. It had been a brutal day. The 13-man party had awoken at 11 the previous night and trudged through the darkness up the icy incline of Everest's north side. Along the way, the temperatures dipped to well below zero. At some point, the water bottle that Grubhofer packed had frozen into solid brick. He was thirsty and exhausted, but he tried not to pay attention to any of that now. After weeks of waiting and years of planning, Grubhofer had made it. It was 9:30 a.m. on May 23, 2019, and a less experienced climber might have thought that the hard part was over. Grubhofer knew better. As he jockeyed for a place to stand at the top of the world, his Sherpa's radio came alive. Kari Kobler, the founder of the Swiss mountaineering agency that had organized Grubhofer's expedition, was radioing urgently from base camp. Bad weather was moving in fast. They had to descend quickly. Grubhofer looked down toward Nepal and could see gray clouds sweeping across the southern face of the mountain. There was something else down there, too, a line of 100 or so climbers in brightly colored suits snaking up the side of the mountain. The crowd seemed incredible, like a bag of Skittles had been scattered down the slope. On the north side, Grubhofer knew, more climbers were tracing his trail up the mountain from Tibet, too. He hopped off the summit and crossed two windswept snowfields, digging unsteadily into the crust with his crampons. Whenever Grubhofer encountered somebody ascending the mountain, etiquette forced him to unclip himself from the rope to step around the climber. Each time he did so, he was aware that a gust of wind or a misstep could send him hurtling to an uncertain fate. Grubhofer had tossed his gargles after they'd frozen in the night and now was wearing Adidas sports sunglasses, which fogged over constantly, requiring him to remove his down mittens in the cold to clean the lenses, a tiny reminder of the multitude of dangerous unpleasantries and unforeseen challenges that crop up on Everest. None of this was new to Grubhofer. A wiry 45-year-old with a thatch of reddish-blonde hair, he'd taken up mountaineering 15 years earlier at 30. That's when Grubhofer, depressed following a divorce, vowed to restart his life. He set out for the Himalayas and scaled 21,250-foot Mira Peak in Nepal. "I was not fit enough, but it got me hooked in," he recalls. Over the following decade, Grubhofer ticked off three of the seven summits, the highest peaks on each of the seven continents. Everest would be his fourth. He took his first shot in 2015, but the adventure was cut short. He was dug in with his team at 21,300 feet at what's known as Advanced Base Camp when an earthquake hit the region, setting off an avalanche that killed over a dozen people at the Nepalese base camp. Grubhofer's expedition was untouched, but no one from either the Tibetan or Nepali side of Everest summited that season. Returning to the mountain hadn't been cheap. Grubhofer, who works for a sightseeing company in Vienna, paid $65,000 for a package that included travel to and from Tibet, visas, guide, and Sherpa fees, and the $11,000 permit issued by the Chinese government. Reaching the summit this time around represented a special kind of thrill, but he refused to celebrate until he was safely down on the mountain. Late in the morning, as he made his way along the crowded trail, a fog rolled in. The wind whipped up, and the snow began to fall. Around noon, Grubhofer arrived at the most dangerous obstacle on the northern side. Step 2, a roughly 100-foot drop, negotiated this time by three rickety ladders placed against the rock and ice facade. The first ladder was about 30 feet long. To reach it, the climber had to twist his body to face the mountain and extend his heavy, crampon-covered boot past an overhang, feeling blindly for the first rung. It was here that the half-dozen climbers ahead of him ground to a sudden halt. "Why the hell aren't we moving?" Grubhofer wondered. "What's holding up the line?" He swiftly identified the problem. A woman in red climbing suit, adorned with the emblems of a Chinese mountaineering group, perched just before the drop-off, unwilling to go forward. The woman's two Sherpa guides were firmly encouraging her to descend the ladder, but she remained paralyzed in apparent fear. For those in the logjam behind her, there was no going around. Everybody was stuck, freezing in the storm. Nearly 6 miles high in the Himalayas, Grubhofer knew conditions were unforgiving. Standing still for long periods in the so-called death zone above 26,000 feet dramatically increased the risk of frostbite, heart attack, stroke, pulmonary or cerebral edema, and death. Grubhofer knew that the Ernst Landgraf, the member of his climbing party whom he had seen on Everest summit, had been exhausted at the top. He could just make out Landgraf, obscured by snowfall, clouds, fog, and people. A few climbers behind him. But Grubhofer didn't know how the 64-year-old was holding up. "Move it!" shouted a climber behind Grubhofer. "Oh," Grubhofer thought, "this is getting serious." This Chinese woman, he was sure, had no business being on the mountain. Why hadn't her guide screened her ahead of time? 30 minutes crawled by, 45. Still, she wouldn't go down to the ladder. "For God's sake," another climber exclaimed, raising his arms in disgust, "why is she not moving?" For much of the year, climbing Everest is an impossible idea, but each May, the roaring jet stream that torments the mountains subsides just enough to allow alpinists a shot at reaching the top. Should the weather suddenly turn, the results are often deadly. John Krakauer's Into Thin Air, made famous in May 1996, disaster during which 8 climbers caught in the blinding whiteout perished from exposure or plunged to their death. The book was a tale of the vicissitudes of nature, the hubris of climbers, and the ineffable lure of the mountain, as well as a reminder that, though Everest had been summited by hundreds, it remains an incredible and dangerous challenge. It was also a scathing portrait of irresponsible guides catering to wealthy, out-of-their-depth dilettantes who were floundering around in what had become an increasingly commercialized enterprise. It was greeted as a wake-up call. But 2 decades on, the Everest experience often seems to have been devolved even further into a circus-like pageant of stunts and self-promotion. In April 2017, DJ Paul Oakenfold outraged mountaineering purists by hosting an EDM concert at the base camp in Nepal. In 2019, 3 Indian climbers returned home to celebratory crowds after they supposedly summited on May 26th. Only to be accused of fraud after other mountaineers claimed that they had never made it past 23,500 feet. And then there were the growing crowds. For 2019's climbing season, Nepal handed out 381 permits to scale Everest, the most ever. The Chinese government distributed more than 100 permits for the northern side. According to the Himalayan database, the number of people summiting Everest has just about doubled in the past decade. And in that time, the mountain has become accessible even to relative novices thanks to a proliferation of cut-rate agencies that require little proof of technical skill, experience, or physical fitness. Some of these companies don't ask any questions, says Rolf Ustra, an Australian mountaineer and founder of a France-based 360 Expeditions, which sent out four clients to the summit in 2019. They are willing to take on anybody, and that compounds the problem for everyone, he said. On May 22nd, the day before Grubhofer reached the top, a long line to the summit had already begun to form. One of those pinned in the throng was a Nepali climber named Nirmal Persia. That morning, Persia snapped a photo of the chaos. The picture showed a near-unprecedented traffic jam on the popular southern side, a column of hundreds of climbers snaking around the knife-like summit ridge toward the Hillary Step, the last obstacle before the top, packed jacket to jacket as if they were queued up for a ski lift in Vail. The image rocketed around the world as the events on the mountain were still developing, raised an urgent question, what the heck's going on the top of Mount Everest? Well, Reinhard Grubhofer breathes from his supplemental oxygen, a necessity in Mount Everest's brutal death zone. In the Himalayan mountains, calamity frequently takes shape off in a distance. Events have a way of cascading. Everest was clogged with climbers in late May of that year because of, among other things, a cyclone that had struck weeks earlier several hundred miles away. Earlier that month, Cyclone Fani made landfall in India as a massive Category 4 storm, blasting warm, wet air westward into the Himalayas. For weeks now, snow and wind buffeted Everest, and the climbers and crews had come to the mountain hoping for clear, calm skies dug in to wait. At the base camp, Kerry Cobbler, who was directing Grubhofer's expedition, was feverishly consulting the forecast, hoping for a break. When the skies finally cleared, suddenly the race was on. We were waiting for good weather at the base camp until May 19th, says Dindi Sherpa, one of the lead Nepali guides in the Cobbler group and one of seven Sherpas hired to help the team. It was apparent to him what was going to happen. We have only a two-day window, and all the people are going to summit at the same time, he said. Grubhofer joined the caravan, and by mid-afternoon on Wednesday, May 22nd, he ascended to Camp 3, a bleak and windswept slope at 27,390 feet. At those heights, the lower air pressure means that the vascular system is receiving far less oxygen than it would at sea level. Most climbers rely on supplemental oxygen. After arriving at the camp, Grubhofer hunkered down to sleep. At 11 o'clock that night, he pushed off toward the summit along with some 80 climbers from a dozen other groups, twice as many as usual, according to one veteran Everest climber. Grubhofer's aim was to arrive at the summit shortly after dawn on Thursday morning, giving him plenty of time to make the descent before encountering the bad weather that typically sweeps in during the afternoon. He carried a bottle of oxygen that would last him between 6 to 9 hours. His Sherpa guide carried two spares for Grubhofer as well as one tank for himself. But 1 hour above the camp, Grubhofer ran into trouble. The snow cover had melted, exposing treacherous patches of bare rock and gravel. You're trying to dig in your crampons, but you're often sliding back, fighting to keep your balance, expending a lot of energy, Grubhofer says. And I asked myself for the first of 1,000 times, should I turn around? After wasting precious time struggling up the rock slope, Grubhofer reached the first of the three difficult steps just below the summit. At least 10 other climbers lined up ahead of him, waiting to make the ascent. To do so, climbers had to squeeze sideways into a rock crevice and pull themselves up by a fixed rope. Grubhofer watched several of them flounder and thought, oh man, what are they doing here? 2 hours later, on the ridge above the second step, he came upon two frozen corpses lying beside the path. Judging from their torn and faded snowsuits and the patches of snow that covered them, Grubhofer could tell that they had been on the mountain for years. One was missing gloves, and the exposed hands had twisted into claws. They seemed to be reaching towards me, he said. The bodies were among as many as 200 corpses abandoned on Everest, most left behind because of the high cost of up to $100,000, and dangers of recovering them. They're grim reminders of the mountain's perils, and they're likely to become more noticeable. As climate change thaws the mountain, the melting snow and ice are exposing additional corpses each year, Grubhofer looked away. You just move on, he says. You refuse to let it affect you. On the north side as well, Kuntal Joysher, an Indian alpinist famed for summiting Himalayan peaks while subsisting on an all-vegan diet, was trying hard to maintain a similar stoicism despite what he was seeing. Georgia was attempting his fourth summit of Everest and had fallen in behind three Indian teenagers who seemed to have no idea how to negotiate the ascent of the second step. Fearful and slow, they took over half an hour to cross the step, usually a 10-minute climb for a strong alpinist. "I was thinking," Georgia recalls, "man, I'm freezing to death, and you guys are causing a traffic jam." There was nothing to do but wait his turn in the frigid wind. You're standing at the ledge of a giant boulder, and it's just wide enough to hold your boots. And a sheer drop on one side, he says, you are totally exposed. Above step three, the scene got worse. Georgia encountered a Sherpa guide sprawled in the snow, separated from his client, and utterly exhausted and delirious. His oxygen bottle was empty, and says Georgia he had been there a while, and he had no idea what to do. Georgia's Sherpa searched the man's bag, found a full bottle, attached it to the man's regulator, and waited for the oxygen to flow. After 10 minutes, he was able to form good sentences and was in good spirits and said, "Okay, I'm ready to go up now." Georgia made the summit at 5:30 in the morning of May 23rd. "It was jam-packed at the top. It was crazy," he says. He stayed only 10 minutes in the cold and wind before heading back down, desperate to avoid the crush of 80 or 90 people whom he could see approaching from both sides. Among those who'd also expected to be near the top by daybreak on Thursday morning was Chris Dare, a dentist with the Canadian Armed Forces. Like Grubhofer, he had started for the summit Wednesday night, falling in a long line of headlamps snaking through the darkness. One of those headlamps belonged to Dare's buddy, Kevin Hines, a gregarious 56-year-old from Galway, Ireland. But Hines made it only 100 yards out of Camp 3 before he turned around. He wasn't feeling up to it and decided the prudent move was to head back. Dare pressed on, figuring he'd reached the top by 6 o'clock in the morning. But long, debilitating waits at each step delayed him until just before 9:30. Soon after his moment at the summit, of course, the weather Thursday afternoon began to turn ugly. At around 10 a.m., Dare was heading back toward Camp 3 when he encountered a member of his team, Cam Barr, a British yoga instructor, still inching toward the summit with her guide. Barr was an experienced mountaineer, but, says Rolf Ustra, the Australian guide leading the group, she wasn't in top physical condition, and it was dangerously late to be making this trek. It's a summit push, as they call it, and she was determined to go forward. Covered with ice, short on oxygen, and physically spent, Dare made it back to Camp 3 at 7 p.m. and collapsed in his tent. He was barely conscious later when a commotion erupted outside. The Sherpa whom Dare had seen earlier in the day helping up the mountain, had staggered into the camp, incoherent and alone. They'd run into trouble, he said, according to Ustra. The Sherpa's oxygen ran out and had been forced to leave Kaur to seek help. Ustra had been to the top once before, but had abandoned his summit push that morning at the second step after a faulty regulator valve had blocked his oxygen flow. "Where's Cam?" he demanded when he saw the Sherpa. "She's up there," the Sherpa gasped. Ustra strapped on his crampons and grabbed an oxygen cylinder and a headlamp. As he prepared to climb, he spotted a light high on the ridge and flashed his headlamp 3 times. 3 flashes returned. Ustra locked in on the point in the darkness where he'd seen the light and set out on the icy slope. When he found Cora, she was curled in the fetal position. Her oxygen had run out. She was drifting in and out of consciousness. It hadn't been Cora who'd been signaled Ustra. Her light was nearly dead. It was another man, a badly weakened Indian climber, who flashed for help, then staggered away. Cora disputes Ustra's timeline, though she told GQ that she's not yet ready to publicly share her story. In Ustra's telling, Cora was practically helpless when he found her on the rock. "Can't move my hands, babe," she whispered. "They're frozen." Ustra strapped her into a sling, clamped it to his harness, and rappelled with her down the buttress. Then he pushed and dragged her back to Camp 3, shouting above the wind to keep her awake. For the first-timers on the mountain, the multitude of climbers who had never been to Everest, the crowds and the chaos might have seemed normal. But the Sherpas knew better. Hundreds of them were scattered on the high slopes that night, and many of them understood that the mountain had never seen anything like this. Each year in the months before the climbing season, mountaineering agencies identify the most agile and fearless men from high-altitude Sherpa villages and then hand them awesome responsibilities. Sherpas lay the fixed ropes that guide climbers to the summit, lug the heavy oxygen bottles to keep their clients alive, and closely monitor their clients' physical and mental states. The work is risky. In April 2014, 16 Sherpas died in an ice avalanche on the Nepali side of Everest. Two Sherpas would die in the spring of 2019 in the Nepali Himalayas. Yet the money, as much as $10,000 per season, provides an escape from the poverty of rural Nepal. The men often form an emotional bond with their clients, living beside them for weeks, sharing their victories and their setbacks. The finest walk, a faint line between being helpful and being obedient, between bowing to their clients' wishes and saying no when those wishes seem to be dangerously misguided. A group offers expedition. One of the lead Sherpas was Dindi Sherpa, a 37-year-old veteran who had worked for Cobbler and Partner since 2008 and had summited Mount Everest 6 times. Having worked his way as a top guide spot on Cobbler's team, Dindi had remained behind at Camp 3 on the day of the summit push. Now, Grubhofer, inching his way down, just past the second step, was headed in Dendi's direction when he heard agitated shouts and cries right behind him. His immediate thought was that his teammate, Ernst Landgraf, was in trouble. Landgraf was experiencing some ateer, but he was exhausted at the top. And as he and Grubhofer sat on the summit that morning, congratulating each other, Grubhofer noticed that Landgraf seemed particularly spent. A Sherpa on his team had the same impression when he confronted Landgraf the night before they set out to the top. He was weak, but he said, "This is my goal. I have to go to the summit." And I thought, let him do it. It's quite difficult to tell him you cannot. The Sherpa faced a dilemma confronted by many guides on Everest, how to respond to the determination of an apparently alien or unfit climber. Only rarely, many experts say, will a Sherpa demonstrate the force of will to override a client's decision to summit. For new recruits trying to make a mark in a competitive business, getting the client to the top often becomes the priority. Grubhofer listened again for the shrieks. "Please don't let it be Ernst," he thought. But it was. Later, Grubhofer learned that Landgraf had slipped while trying to plant his foot on a ladder. Grubhofer was told that because Landgraf had been clipped by his carabiner to the fixed line when he fell, he banged into the ladder and then dangled limply on the line. Guides quickly attempted to free him. The wind was blowing, the temperature was dropping, and the climbers behind Landgraf's suspended body were desperate to get off the mountain. Later, Kuntaya Joysher heard that the waiting climbers were getting agitated. "Cut him off the rope," some yelled. "We're getting blocked. We'll die." Two rescuers struggled to get Landgraf off the line. After determining that he was dead, they pushed him aside and left his body hanging there. The exact cause of his death is unknown, but Kuntal Joysher says that at that altitude, with a weakened body under intense stress, the slightest stumble can be disastrous. A small fall or slip can cause your heart rate to shoot up to such a level, he says, that you will have a massive heart attack. On the other side of the mountain, the Nepalese approach was turning into its own scene of confusion and death on Thursday. Gyanendra Shrestha, a Nepalese government liaison officer at the Everest base camp, had foreseen the trouble, watching days earlier as over 200 climbers milled around the tents, waiting to set off for the top. One of them was an old friend of his, Kalpana Das, an Indian attorney who had been summiting Everest in 2008. Das had been given a hero send-off by thousands of admirers in her hometown before she set out for Everest in April as part of an all-woman's team of climbers. But Shrestha, having observed her during acclimatizing runs up the mountain in mid-May, saw that she was off her game. "She was very slow, and she was a decade older this time, 54, Shrestha says. "I told her at the base camp, 'Don't push yourself much. I have a sense you cannot do it this year.'" Das struggled on the Kamu icefall, the first obstacle beyond the base camp. She eventually made it to the summit around 1 p.m. on Thursday, but she collapsed on the way down. When Shrestha received a mayday call from Das Sherpa, Das was unconscious, barely breathing. The guide said he was too exhausted to bring Das alone. A 4-man rescue team was dispatched, but by the time they reached her hours later, Das had perished. Shortly after dawn the previous morning, Donald Cash, a Utah software salesman who had quit his job in December to devote himself to high-altitude climbing, had also reached the top. The achievement marked the completion of Cash's 7 Summits project, and overjoyed, he performed a little victory jig at the summit. Then, without warning, he sank to his knees and toppled over. Cash's guide raced to his side and opened wide the valve on his oxygen. The rush of air revived Cash, and the Sherpa helped him down to the Hillary Step, a 40-foot-high rock outcropping at 28,800 feet. A group of Sherpas had been dispatched to help bring Cash down, but when they arrived, it was too late. Cash had collapsed again and never got back up. His body was left on the mountain, as his family wished. Largely unaware of the tragedies unfolding around them, the other teams on the route raced higher up the mountain. Angelai Kumkarni, an experienced marathoner and high-altitude climber from Mumbai, and her husband, Sharad Kumkarni, summited on the same day as Cash, according to an account in the Times of India. After leaving the summit with her husband, Kumkarni fell ill. Above Camp 4, the paper said she collapsed and died. A video shows a pair of rescuers, presumably Sherpas, attempting to move Kumkarni's limp body. She lies unresponsive, her right arm extended, hand clutching the fixed rope. The surviving members of Angelai Kumkarni's team staggered, mourning and half-dead, into Camp 4. Nearby, another exhausted Indian climber from a different expedition, 27-year-old Nehal Bhagwan, who, according to the Times of India, had abandoned a 2014 Everest climb 1,300 feet below the summit, would die of altitude sickness just before midnight on the 23rd. Bhagwan had been climbing with a Nepalese agency called Peak Promotion, which had already lost three other climbers in the Himalayas the week before. The manager of Peak Promotion told GQ that the deaths in 2019 represent the first time the agency lost clients in its 27-year history. She also said that Peak Promotion has guidelines in place to ensure that Sherpas have extensive mountaineering experience. Another Nepalese agency, Seven Summit Treks, founded by four Sherpa brothers in 2010, and now one of the biggest mountaineering companies in Nepal, had an even worse record in 2019. On May 16th, a client of theirs named Seamus Lawless, a 39-year-old computer science professor at Trinity College in Dublin, unhooked himself from the safety rope to relieve himself near Camp 4, according to Seven Summits. A climbing companion speculates that a freak gust of wind blew him off the mountain, and he apparently fell hundreds of feet to his death. His body was never recovered. That same night, Ravi Thakur, a 27-year-old Seven Summits client from Haryana, India, died in his tent at the same camp. And in the days that followed, disaster struck three more times on expeditions led by Seven Summits on nearby Makalu, the world's fifth highest mountain. Now, next week, we're going to continue this story in Armchair Traveler, and we're going to go to the conclusion, learning more about Grubhofer and his group and what finally happened to them. So I want you to join us for that. And again, this was originally published in 2019, December, as a matter of fact, GQ magazine, and then republished with permission here on Read It Later's website. So hope you've enjoyed this part of the journey, and that you'll join us for the conclusion on next week's episode of Armchair Traveler. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website, again, is ncreadingservice.org, and that is all one word, NC Reading Service. Now, if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.